Erlem Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. Tell you what a great debate this is, and as always, so eclectic. And as always, want to get your views. Do continue to keep involved. It's your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So tweet at Verulam Sports. Of course, we're still continuing to shine a light on sporting dynasties, and I know you've got your favourites. Tweet us at Verulam Sports. Oh, again, Premier League predictions. That's going to conclude tonight's chat. And I know out there, you are an absolute punditry genius, aren't you? You get them right all the time. Tell you what, put your money where those mouths are. Tweet at Verulam Sport with your Premier League predictions and indeed anything to do with sport at all. We love having your views. Tweet at Verulam Sport and keep involved. We're keeping involved with tonight's debate. We are dissecting wonderfully massive, strong, sustained sporting success, which equals dynasty. Neil, what are you got up next for us?
Right, I'm going for WWE wrestling. That is a phenomenal company, if you like. It's a whole entertainment package. There's various different angles of what they've done there, what Vince McMahon's done in the wrestling. It all started back in the early 50s as Capitol, and then went into Titan, and then WWF, which, for obvious reasons, they had to change. So it went to World Wrestling Federation Entertainment, and then, as we know it now, as WWE. It's something that sort of been about for a while, but it's now sort of a big part of our sporting culture, if you like. It's all over the TV. They have their moments like everybody else, but seeing the wrestlers come through various angles, and I've interviewed a couple of them myself. Rockstar Spud springs to mind in a hotel in London. So I've sort of done a few things, really, but there are feeders into WWE. I think WCW is part of it. You got TNA, Impact. There's just so much which is all run by the McMahon family, and there's other parts to it, and it's just so big. It's got so big so quickly.
It is a cultural phenomenon, isn't it? WrestleMania, for instance, the granddaddy of them all, every March, is kind of one of those events that really does capture the imagination, even if you're not really a fan. I've got to be honest with you. I've not been into professional wrestling or sports entertainment for many years. I used to love it as a kid. But I tell you, it's great. We were lucky here in Radio Verulam, one of the jewels of the crown of the Radio Verulam broadcasting squad team entity, is the mighty Lee Canderton. And he actually has another persona. He's Lee Bamba, and he is a professional pro wrestling referee. Goes up and down the land doing that. And he's come to Watford. It's been at the Auburn Arena. And it's fascinating to talk to him about this. First of all, I'm really interested to get your take on the dynasty McMahon. And it really is a family affair. I think his father kind of was instrumental in this. One second, I'm going to ask you about how it evolved really through the vision of McMahon into out of a very territory-driven kind of entity into this national and now international kind of just phenomenon. But quickly, I've got to advocate the devil here. because they're very open. McMahon actually hates almost the phrase professional wrestling. He coined the phrase sports entertainment, and it does that. I mean, some of the feats of athleticism that you witness at this event is astonishing. You're combining power, devastating athleticism, and ballet and gymnastics and all kinds of feats of ultra athleticism. It is that sporting component. But these days, kayfabe is long ago finished with the internet and this and that. And it's just very open, and everybody knows, really, don't they? For all the feats of athleticism, for all the phenomenal athletes that these guys, these pro wrestlers truly are. And I mean, there's no debate about that one. But the results are preconditioned. Everybody knows who will win and when they will win. And it's kind of, you know, orchestrated. For me, I question, therefore, its validity in the sporting frame, where the beauty of sport is that it's always open for a change of results and things, momentum and all these wonderful properties. I embrace sport as it applies to darts. I truly think darts and snooker, they're sports for me. You know, there's no preordained results, requires great human skill and massive amount of application. But for all of the athleticism, and I'm a big fan, I'm slightly advocating the devil here, and I've always loved Chanta Lee. But Neil, your take on that aspect, because it is open about it being preconditioned, preordained result-wise, is it therefore a sport? Or are we talking the highest levels of sporting theatre and entertainment, but not necessarily sport per se?
I think in some ways it borders on the line of sport, but also more, I would say, theatrical entertainment. But there is an element of sport there, because you still need the fitness to do it. You still need to be able to hold people up, somersault and all whatever they do, all the different moves, regardless of whether it's pre-orchestrated or not. There is a form of sport, if you like, in the athleticism that's involved. However, the side of the decisions already made prior to that. Now, on a more local level, I know a couple of wrestlers, the Bombay Bad Boys, and a few, Chris Kay and people like that from the Portsmouth area, from SWF. And I understand through all that it's all preconditioned, but it's the entertainment value of how it gets there is the thing, I think, with wrestling as a whole. I do think it borderlines a sport in some way, but it's more a family entertainment.
Yeah. Hence the phrase Vince McMahon coined, which is sports entertainment, and I think it's a good one. As I say, I truly do admire the feats of athleticism, the necessary human power that they demonstrate. They do astonishing things that I couldn't possibly dream of achieving. And I give you an insight as well. I'm sure you know the name Brock Lesnar, who was a reigning champion for a long time. And he actually entered into the UFC, very much a real sport, mixed martial arts. And he became champion at mixed martial arts. Again, he had pedigree at the amateur athletics. And this guy is a beast. I mean, he's 6'5", 285 of pure muscle. And he's just an absolute phenom. We're going to be talking NFL in a minute in my final dynasty selection. But he also did have time at the Vikings Minnesota Vikings, just to give you an idea of his crossover athleticism. So the fact that the likes of Brock Lesnar have kind of cut through into what you might call more straightforward sports does speak volumes, does give a testimony to the kind of athletes that this world and the phenomenon of WWE attracts. So I think that's an interesting point. Again, I always invite your views here. Tweet us at Verum Sport Wrestling. Where does it cross that wonderful borderline between sport and entertainment? Can it really be a sport, though? It is. They're open about it. All preordained. Jason, before I go back to Neil and dissect the explosion that McMahon's vision was, moving wrestling from a territorial-based kind of organization into this now global phenomenon, I'd love your quick opinion on the question mark we've raised. Wrestling, sports entertainment, should we get rid of the sport?
It's a great question. I think the clue is kind of like in the name and the kind of loose definition that you've kind of hinted to there, that McMahon has kind of embraced himself there, that it is world wrestling entertainment. You know, it is, it's not a sport. And the definition of a sport, according to the dictionary, is a physical activity that is governed by a set of rules or customs, often engaged in competitively, or an activity involving physical exertion, skill that's governed by a set of rules, etc., or an active pastime of recreation. I would say it meets the third definition. It's an active pastime and recreation, but I don't think it meets the first two because the competitive element is not there. I would say that it's sport theatre, and it's probably competed by sportsmen themselves, because like you said, there's somebody actually entered MMA. But in terms of actually whether it is sporting in the sense that you strive for elements, no, because it's scripted. But I do like the fact that it is a dynasty. I would agree with Neil that it's something amazing, but I would say it's probably more an entertainment dynasty rather than sporting. But I love the fact that it's brought up and it brings out this amazing debate once again.
Absolutely fascinating. Again, always get involved. Tweet at Verum Sports. Again, it is a dynasty in the truest sense of the word. It's almost Merovingian-esque, this McMahon clan. I'm going to circle back to that and come to Neil again. And thank you, Neil, for introducing this. It is a fascinating topic. Neil, again, for me, it's been many, many years since I've actively followed the world of sports entertainment. But I'll tell you what, my youngest brother actually went to WrestleMania a few years ago. And it was, for him, was one of the proudest moments of his life. He said when he was a youngster, I'm going to go to WrestleMania. And, you know, God love him, he did. And from people around the world, I speak about when, for instance, I was at the international series in the NFL when it came to London and had the whole world there. Wrestling does that to like almost a different level. Whichever way you slice it, it is a cultural phenomenon. And I will say this much, there are obviously those people who get a bit sniffy about wrestling. And I do kind of understand where they're coming from. But I would always come back to them in this and say, look, okay, you're watching a movie, you're seeing Tom Cruise do all these crazy stunts or whatever, you know, guys, he had a stunt double. You know, he had it was very controlled. You just kind of set aside that disbelief and you just let it wash over you for a piece of theatre or a movie, whatever it might be. You know, I'm not being funny about it. When you're watching Macbeth on the stage in the highest of theatres, right? Guys, it's just acting. Nobody's dying here. There's no witches happening, you know? And you just don't take that. There's none of that sniffiness. It's almost like a different aesthetic. And some people want to kind of get a little bit sniffy and almost snobbish about wrestling as to whether it's pure entertainment, sports entertainment. Again, everybody's opinion is going to be divergent there. I would suggest, though, give it a try. Particularly, again, give it a try on the local level. When these guys do come to the Auburn Arena or Watford or whatever, and I'm sure we'll be chatting to Radio Verum's own Lee Canderton again in the near future and his wrestling personae, Lee Bamba. And all of that is about persona and becoming larger than life. It's fascinating. But coming back now, Neil, to this almost dynasty in its truest sense, almost, like I say, Merovingian or Tudor or what have you, because Clan McMahon, it's still in the family. I think his daughter is Ken, instrumental in the kind of story writing aspect of it. His son, Shane, occasionally performs. But Vince himself was the son of the original McMahon, wasn't he? He was one of the original promoters of what became
WWF. But talk to me a little bit about the vision of McMahon. I guess it culminated in WrestleMania 1, and of course, WrestleMania 3, where Andre the Giant famously was slammed by the immortal Hulk Hogan, really sealing the deal of wrestling as a cultural iconic event. But tell me a little bit about the transition and the vision of Vincent Kennedy McMahon, Vincent Jr., to take wrestling from a very parochial, territorial-based almost carnival-like property from there to where we are in 2020, this global phenomenon. Just to describe a little bit about the heritage and the vision of the McMahon family.
Well, it's all a family, what I would say, a family sort of business. It's an entertainment business, which obviously started way back in the early 50s, and then it's just progressed and progressed. You've had all different strains of wrestling. You've had the UK wrestling with Big Daddy in the 80s and Giant Haystacks, and then all of a sudden, sort of early, late 80s, early 90s, and moving forward, all of a sudden the explosion with all the different sports that Sky Sports sort of decided they were going to bring to the table, you got WWE every week, or WWF every week.
Just a testimony on that. It's a great shout. And, on that level, irrespective of where one categorizes it, just to give it its context, outside of the Premier League, which, of course, is the jewel in the crown and Sky's kind of sporting offerings, the next most watched, call it a sport whether you want, it's on Sky Sports, is WWE. And that's remained that way from its early days, way back in the sort of early 90s, right up to present time. So again, it just reflects, whatever one may categorize it, this or that, its appeal, panning generations, is astonishing. Neil, very quickly, appreciate you bringing this phenomenal dynasty into our debate. Final quick thoughts on the role, culturally, of the WWE.
Well, it's spread from what it was. Now it's like the international. They've gone through SmackDown and Raw being together. It's now been separated. They've got their own shows and their own events now, and it's just changed, and there's more being offered, and I think it's just going to get bigger and bigger, and they're bringing wrestling to the UK as well, which they've been doing for a good number of years, which I think is good for the brand itself. And like any other sport, you could say the American football, that coming over to the UK, it's all about expanding brands and expanding businesses. Manchester United have done it in China and various other countries. And clubs should be taking a look at where they could go, because you and sporting companies, if you like, clubs, they should be take a look at what people like Manchester United, Tottenham, then you can go for the PDC, you could go down to snooker, what they're doing, wrestling, American football. It's all global now. It's not just nationalized, it's global.
It's a global world, and isn't it exciting? Obviously, it has its pros and its cons, as all things in life do. But again, I think you made some wonderful points there. As always, I know you listen. I've got loads of views on this one. Tweet us at Verum Sport. Keep the machine busy. But right now, we're going to get the machine busy and ask him to kindly provide us with his final sporting dynasty for our consideration.
Well, this one here, I'm so excited to talk about. And obviously, this is audio, but people, if they were watching, they would see that I've been proudly drinking out of a Holland mug today, because I'm talking about Johan Cruyff, and I will boldly say this, and I think everything that I'm going to say will back this up. I think he is the most important person to modern football in terms of bringing the beautiful style that we've seen with Pep, but also with Bielsa, Ball, and many other managers around the world. He has brought that into the modern game. And in terms of Cruyff, it's quite an interesting one, because in many ways you'd say that he had quite a humble career in many ways in terms of management, because it was only 11 years. But then, my goodness, what did he win in those 11 years? He managed two clubs, his two basically big clubs that he played for, Ajax and Barcelona, and he changed the world with those two clubs. And Jonathan Wilson really kind of backs up my point of view, the amazing football writer. If you haven't read his books, go do so, because they are brilliant kind of insights. But he backs up my viewpoint kind of saying that Cruyff is so instrumental when he says that his ideas had shaped the game more profoundly than those of any other, perhaps, thinker in history. And I think that kind of summarises...
Fascinating point.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what as well. There aren't many players as well. He was a great player.
My goodness.
A football move that's his own name is associated, of course, the Cruyff kind of turn. It's just, you know, again, when you've achieved that level as a player and then cross over into a manager, it's astonishing. Jason, I know you have such admiration for Cruyff. Can't wait to continue to hear your analysis here.
Yeah, so in terms of Cruyff, you know, I've mentioned their Ajax, and unfortunately, we don't really have enough time to analyse that as well. So I'm looking just at his management career at Barcelona. And he inspired a new wave of beautiful football across the globe, you know, undoubtedly so. And I'll chat about the kind of long-termness of that as well. But what I would say, like any good philosopher, he comes from a long lineage of great philosophers. He comes from Jack Reynolds, Vic Buckingham, Rinus Michels, but also, funnily enough, all the way back to Scotland. Hungary can also kind of be thrown in the mix there with total football, passing football as well. It's a really weird kind of history with total football there. But with these kind of discussions there, I'd say that Buckingham, Michels, Reynolds are kind of the Socrates to the Plato that is Cruyff. And Ajax kind of was the beginnings, but then he moved over to Barcelona. But my goodness, he joined at a time of turmoil. This wasn't an easy kind of thing for him to create the beautiful football that he wanted. He took over just after the Hesperia mutiny, and there was hysteria around the club, because what happened there was a load of players kind of fell out with the management of the club, and they kind of wouldn't play because of money issues, you know. Big shock, that's kind of become the norm in football nowadays. But at the time, it was unthinkable. 442 explains that how dire the situation was, that Barcelona had gone from European Cup finalists in 1986 to a laughing stock in just 2 years. And that just kind of contextualizes what an amazing job Cruyff did, not only to create this beautiful football, but from what many would consider an impossible situation. So the Belgrana, Los Cules, as they call them, had one league title in just 14 years. But after 8 years at the helm, Cruyff brought 11 trophies, four back-to-back La Liga titles, and Barcelona's first European Cup, now called the Champions League trophy. And I know people will be interested to how he did it. And it started overall with an imposition of ideology from day one, kind of benefited by the La Hesperia situation. He was able to get rid of 15 players and bring 13 in. Players like Chiqui Bergestan, who's now obviously one of the big players with Man City, with Pep Guardiola, and Eusebio came in, plus players from La Masia were given a chance. But he also brought in the revolutionary 3-4-3 formation, which seemed absolutely crazy at the time, of 4-4-2 or 3-5-2. This was something that people wouldn't even given the light of day, but Cruyff came in, first training session, put it in on the board. And at first, the players were actually a little bit critical. And Cruyff himself said, "I was criticised for playing three at the back, but that was the most idiotic thing I'd ever heard. What we needed to do was fill the middle of the pitch with players where we needed them most. I much preferred winning 5-4 than 1-0. He was always about the beauty of the football. And also, that's so Cruyff, isn't it? Calling people that criticise them idiots. But the system, the 3-4-3, was much more simple than an arbitrary formation. And this is something that we talked about before, Tony, isn't it? That formations quite often kind of constrain teams. We've seen it with England. We've seen it with some of the greatest teams in kind of history. But here at Barcelona, it was the complete opposite of that. Mm. The 3-4-3 was giving players, I think, the kind of intelligence and crediting it for them to kind of control their situations. You know, Ferrer and Serhi were a part of the three at the back, but were actually fullbacks. But they also played as inverted wingers. It's just fascinating stuff. At times, they were joining the midfield. Koeman was a great passer, centre-back, but then he'd played that Regista role where he'd kind of move up the field and Guardiola would come back. This was pure total football. The goalkeeper was coming out and playing balls. You know, people hadn't seen this since the 70s under Ajax. And this whole kind of thing of stretching the half space, making the pitch as big as possible, was so, so important for that lovely style of football. Space was the important thing, but also possession, pressing and passing. Those were the three P's that Cruyff wanted to bring to the club. And yeah, the libero would kind of step up from the defence. These were all things that people hadn't seen from a long while. But from all this, you can see that the footballers were given freedom. They had to be clever, but also Cruyff wanted a different type of player. So Tifa Football kind of explains this as creating battling attacking patterns, but this had to come from somewhere. The problem with Barcelona previously had they been focused solely on the physicality of players, not the intelligence of players, not how well they passed, how well they played. And this was, you know, this was a problem not just with Barcelona, but with all football at the time. 1.8 metres was the height the players had to have. And there was this thing called the Endure Puebla de la Muñeca, which was Doll's Trial. And this was when players were about, you know, puberty's age, 13 through to 15, 16. They were given this Doll's Trial to see if they would reach 5'9". This was the baseline for if you were a Barcelona player. Not, oh my God, he's a really good footballer, this and that. But Cruyff came in.
This is really quickly, and I can't wait to hear you finish this and how this evolved. However, in our present world, right now, obviously Cruyff set the model, and that beautiful intelligence and freedom and fluidity and space awareness that he was seeking over and beyond physicality. But what fascinates me is, now, when you say the word Barcelona, maybe before you think Cruyff, if you've only got a certain memory of football, probably the name that comes to mind would be Messi.
Yeah.
Now, I think he came to Barcelona from Argentina very, very young, but was very tiny, diminutive as a youth at that puberty time. And I believe, I haven't studied this, but I believe that he was actually given a program of sort of testosterone. I'm not saying growth hormone injections or anything in that way, but certainly certain hormone, testosterone, I believe, kind of supplementary focus, if that makes sense. So I guess, to what extent is that the case? Because you can maybe fill in the gaps. And to what extent does that harken back to this era, pre-Cruyff? I'm just wondering for your quick take on that before you continue your wonderful eulogizing vis-a-vis Mr. Cruyff.
Well, the funny thing about kind of Messi there, you know, it's really right of you to kind of bring it up, because he joined the club at around 2000. So, you know, as a young boy, I think he was about 13 years old or something like that. Absolutely crazy. He was joined by signing a napkin. That was the way his first contract was, on a napkin, and they keep that in a safe at Barcelona. But you're 100% right to say that Messi, Barcelona are kind of intermingled now. But without Cruyff, this wouldn't have been possible, because the problem was that people didn't realise the value of little players like Xavi, Iniesta, Thiago, Cazorla, and Messi himself. You know, all these kind of players were overlooked for so many years. And it makes you wonder how many kind of these players have slipped through the kind of systems because they weren't physical beings. So you're 100% right there to kind of point it out there. And Messi would not have been possible. The change of ethos there was because of Cruyff. And again, kind of open it up to La Masia. Cruyff didn't just introduce the kind of better players in terms of they're just pure footballing attributes, but it was also from a young age he brought this new philosophy. So from the littlest youngest players to the oldest players in the squad, they were all taught this new Barca way. And an interesting one that we talked about here, Pep Guardiola, one of the disciples of Cruyff here, was one of these players that initially benefited from this. So when Cruyff joined the club, Pep Guardiola was going for absolute torment. You know, he loved Barcelona, he still does. And he was told that he probably wouldn't make it because he wasn't this kind of 5'9". He did grow into it, but lots of these players were kind of thrown out. But Cruyff said, no more. Xavi's, Iniesta's, Thiago's, all these kind of players, we want them here. The objective was about teaching everything that the club stood for, not just physicality. It was about passing, possession, and pressing, the kind of things. Mm. And my favourite quote from Cruyff about this is that he said that he wanted these kind of players because, yes, that they were small, they might have been pushed off the ball, but physically they were amazing in terms of their pressing. They pressed like rats, is what Cruyff said. It's a lovely kind of imagery, you know, that maybe they were small, that they you know, couldn't fight on the ball in that kind of sense, but my God, they'd give it their all. But kind of as well, with the Cruyff story, we've always got to have drama, don't we? Much like Ferguson at Manchester United, the Cruyff revolution might have not even happened before it happened because of the results not going their way. And like Ferguson, it was a domestic competition that saved him. The 1990 Copa del Rey saved a bacon because Barcelona that season finished 11 points off. But then 1990 to 91, acquisitions combined with La Masia's fruits, and then the most beautiful football was played on the pitch. As I said, four back-to-back La Ligas. And it, in many ways, the kind of sad thing was that Cruyff wasn't given a second chance. 1994, the European Cup final, they were soundly beaten by anti-Cruyff manager Capello 4-0. Cruyff kind of then went maybe a little bit power mad. He got rid of loads of the squad. He told them he didn't want them after he said that he did, which, you know, kind of loses faith from a lot of players. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't given the time, and politics kind of came in the way, much in a similar way to Guardiola recently. The politics of the club didn't allow him to continue. But Cruyff, you know, from then on, kind of shaped European football. We look at the tiki-taka of Spain, Las Rojas, and then obviously Barcelona under Guardiola. So much so that even Cruyff was more of a fan of Spain in that World Cup final 2010 than he was of his own Holland. He was actually disgusted. He said, "The ugly, vulgar, hard, hermetic, hardly eye-catching football of Holland was disgusting to watch." He was ashamed that his country played like that. And it just shows you his dedication, not to teams or to countries. It was to his ideology. And to finish, I think Guardiola put it so nicely. Johan Cruyff painted the chapel, and the Barcelona coaches since have merely tried to restore it or improve it. And I think that analogy is perfect for me, because he transferred football from just the sport into art.
Love your work, the beautiful game embodied by a beautiful mind. And I tell you what as well, I mean, when you think of some of those sort of borderline diminutive, but no doubt technically proficient artists on the pitch, Iniesta, Pep himself, whole heap of others. I mean, goodness me, what a debt does the Spanish national team owe him? If you think for so long, Spain had been tarnished, haven't they? Almost equivalent to England with this golden generation that never quite achieved tag. Well, they threw that out the window, didn't they? And my goodness, be inspired by the likes of Iniesta and so many others. You know, what was it? I think it was two consecutive World Cups and a European Championship in between that. I don't think anybody in the whole of football history has achieved that level of consistent dynasty-esque success, made possible, really, one could argue, and I don't think it's a massively hyperbolic claim, through to the commitment and vision you've wonderfully explained to us here tonight through Johan Cruyff. Again, Johan, what a player on the pitch with that Cruyff turn. Turned into a genius of a manager, a true artisan, a true Renaissance man. And we are very grateful for you, the man, the machine, McKenna, for bringing that discussion to the party. I'm going to finish up in a moment with my analysis from a man who is a little bit more stoic in his philosophy, but a philosopher nonetheless, and a true winner. Indeed, the winningest head coach in all of American football history. I'm talking Bill Belichick. It's not without its controversies, this one. But I'm telling you now, there is something quite sublime about the New England Patriots under Bill Belichick. What a record. What a dynasty this truly is. Of course, it combines. Sometimes you have that perfect storm. It's kind of become almost an underlying theme in tonight's discussion. In order for these dynasties to come into effect, you need so many rare combination of factors to come into play. You need that visionary. You need that to be aligned with a correct array of players to fulfill that vision. You need a lot of people buying into a big picture thinking. And you need that to also, along the way, you earn that aura that sometimes coincides with a little bit of good fortune. And all of that comes to play with the New England Patriots circa 2000 through to present day. And of course, just a brief mention to what many people call the GOAT, the greatest of all time in Brady. Look, whether in statistically he is, he's had some great performances, some standout moments. And again, in terms of winningest, he is standalone above Montana, above Peyton Manning, above anybody else who's played the game at QB, the winningest. But what I'm going to reference Brady, but for me, this dynasty is all about Belichick. And what he's done is sensational. I've got to give this the context, okay? Just the brute facts. In this 20-year span since he took up the helm of the Patriots, before he had, before he came into effect, they'd been in one Super Bowl final before losing to the Green Bay Packers a few years before this. And before then, of course, they lost that. So had a grand total of zero Super Bowl victories in their history. It's under Bill Belichick, under this era, six Super Bowl wins in 20 years. Okay, Belichick previously claimed two rings as defensive coordinator at the great New York Giants. And it's that record, that six Super Bowl wins, means that all time, we've used this word a lot tonight, and it's always one of my favorites because, again, we love a good stat. And one of the stats that stands out that indicates greatness is that of winningest. Ain't no other coach in all NFL history, okay? There's been some greats. My own 49ers and the Bill Walsh and the West Coast offense. Three. The Super Bowl itself, of course, is named after Green Bay Packers. Great coach, Vince Lombardi, got two. So many others. Joe Gibbs, his Washington Redskins era in the 80s, three Super Bowl crowns. Chuck Knoll from Pittsburgh Steelers, four. Ain't nobody even in the league of Bill Belichick with six. And that applies also to Brady, hence the GOAT moniker. Facts don't lie, chaps. They stack up. And in that time, 17 AFC East division titles in 20 years. The team has played in 13 AFC championship games, 9 Super Bowl appearances. Bill Belichick has got an overall record of 8 Super Bowl rings and 4 times a runner-up. The guy oozes winning. He's almost transcendental, even beyond somebody that I know and love, and I'm on record of knowing and loving, Mr. Marino. Marino's record pales into insignificance compared to Belichick's. Now, what I would say, this has to be appreciated in its context. The nature of American football is very much a respectful one of salary cap. Okay, if you look at the last 2 years' playoffs, there were 11 teams who made the playoffs in those 2 years, who the previous year didn't make the playoffs. So the nature of salary cap allied with the wonderful and weirdly quirky in an American culture, which we know is uber capitalistic. They have this beautiful egalitarian sporting culture whereby the team finishing worst gets the top pick in the draft, the choice player. That doesn't necessarily always correlate to that player transcending and translating at the NFL level, but it certainly gives the chance for teams to redevelop, reorganize, and strengthen year on year. It's a league that places its kind of premium on parity, right? And in that culture, the Patriots and Bill Belichick have smashed it asunder. They've broken up the rule book. And that is truly, truly astonishing in context. I mean, it really, really is transcendental. Belichick has the most playoff wins all time with 31. And again, coming back, Jason, I kind of riffed on his philosophy. I know, as you say, there was something almost Socratic about the Cruyff. I mean, Belichick is much more stoic, much more of a Marcus Aurelius, or even, I would say, a bit more of a Friedrich Nietzsche almost. Placing a premium on kind of will to power. And he comes from a kind of culture himself where, a la Cruyff, although from a different line, American football is in his DNA, in his blood. And that kind of stoicism comes from the fact that his grandfather, Bill Edwards, was inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame from a coaching perspective. And his father, who he calls his icon, his idol, his model, if you would, was one of the famed coaches at the U.S. Navy Academy. And he takes that DNA, that true football life, and he lives it to the fullest. There is something very military-esque about his approach. And obviously, sometimes that will cut people up the wrong way. But he doesn't care. As with all the great cultures, it is the team is bigger than any one of its sum parts. Egos have to be put off if you want to make it with the Pats. It's that simple. And it's for that reason that he's had this just tenure of glorious, glorious successes. And I just think that is absolutely genius. However, to be that black and white isn't actually to do his genius a fair service, because what I would actually argue is the singular most distinctive element about the past of the Belichick coaching model is that whilst he's a defensive guru, and there was that old one, that old maxim in American football that says defense wins Super Bowls, and it still stands up even to today. But whilst he has that kind of background and pedigree, the genius about Belichick, some of those other coaches that I mentioned, for instance, the 49ers' great Bill Walsh, was famed for a style of play. They called it the West Coast offense. Okay. A Tony Dungy, for instance, innovated what's now known and used and mimicked throughout the league, what they call cover two defense. Okay. Chuck Knoll had his own brand of football. Now, this is all well and good. And of course, it reflects a nuanced philosophy and a very focused football ideology. But what is almost unique about Belichick, and this is why he's achieved this level of sustained greatness, this is why, for me, the Pats are a true all-time great sporting dynasty, is that he is not a slave to any one form of football. For him, football is a very basic game. What he does, and it sounds so obvious, but obviously it's much easier said than actually actualized, okay? But what he basically does is identify an opposition's greatest strength and take it away from them. If they've got a star wide receiver, we'll put two men on him. If their game is all about run, we'll stop the run. We'll turn what they do well against them. And then we control our controllables. It sounds so basic. But basically, all too many coaches haven't got the, I would say, the wherewithal, or maybe they have too much conviction in their own overall ideology, that they're not capable to be fluid. It's my ideology will overcome more often than not. Well, that's great. But what's even greater is to have that capacity to identify the team in front of you and then nullify their strengths and then capitalize on their weaknesses. And at that level, there's never been anybody before. I doubt there will be again since who has had that gift. It's an absolute art. Along the way, there have been so many moments and so many of these great dynasties that we've spoken about. They win the clutch. They win the crunch. I have this tautology that I use all the time. Winners win. Yeah, no word of lie, Tony. Of course they win. But why? Because they got that culture. They've got those guts. They've got those intangibles that transcend data or anything else. It's when the chips are down, cometh the hour, cometh the men. And they've won so many Super Bowls thanks to Mr. Clutch, Adam Vinatieri, literally the NFL's, I think, all-time top scorer, one of the great clutch kickers. He won the first Super Bowl with a clutch last-minute kick in the final, which was tremendous. And he's done that replicated on so many occasions. I want to talk about briefly, again, talking about Carpe Diem, seize the day, because now Brady has moved on to pastures new. It will be fascinating to witness how this aging warrior performs at the talented Tampa Bay Buccaneers. But for all time, Brady Belichick will be synonymous. Great coach, maybe the GOAT GOAT in terms of QB in Brady. Now, Brady is, for me, a real kind of, in microcosm, what New England Patriots are all about. Because this guy was unheralded. He was, I think, a sixth or seventh round draft pick. You see pictures of early Brady. He isn't even really a physical specimen. Now, since he sees the day, and I paint the picture, you look at him now into his 40s, still putting up world numbers. And he's very committed in the holistic approach to sporting success. Takes his diet immensely, almost assiduously, seriously, into yoga and all these other kind of important sports regimes, which add to longevity, which applied to talent equals greatness. But again, in those early days, was a seventh round pick, Mr. Joe Nobody in American football context. Now, he was backup to, at the time, the man who was Mr. New England Patriots, Drew Bledsoe. Drew Bledsoe, just to give you an idea, was almost like, for instance, how Raul was at Real Madrid, whereby to lose Raul would be unthinkable. He was the team. He was that synonymous and that gifted. I would suggest maybe more naturally gifted than Brady from a pure physicality point of view. Anyway, there came a moment in this first year of 2001 where they got that first of now six bowls where Bledsoe got injured. And then this unheralded seventh round Joe Nobody, now Mr. Tom Brady, who is a household name world over, was thrust upon the stage. And he wasn't setting the world alight, but what he was doing was winning. He was winning games. You know, and again, they would get that to what happens often in American football, what they call it a quarterback controversy, whereby, of course, the star, Raul, in context, returns to fitness. And then Belichick had to make a really tough judgment call. And he went, I'm sorry, Mr. Star, Mr. You know, Drew Bledsoe. I know you're the man, but we're winning. We're winning football here. And this team ain't won football for a long time, really, not since that time when you lost to Green Bay in the Super Bowl final. So I've got to go with Brady until he proves otherwise. The rest, as they say, is history. But that's my point. In these great dynasties, and there have been so many we've discussed tonight, it is this capacity where all these imponderables come together in almost a predestined style, and then you have that perfect storm where success breeds a sustained success. Brady and Belichick are two of the GOATs all time, and I would suggest two of the GOATs pan all sport for their sheer will, their class, their acumen, and their level of sustained exception performance. It's unbelievable. Now, there have been controversial moments in this dynasty. I think any era of sustained success in a sport of inches, in a game of such ferocity, you're going to be hard pushed not to be associated with some degree of controversial moments. It kind of almost adds to the legend, I suppose. The two that spring to mind. First one, in the bowl in which they beat the what was then dubbed the greatest show on turf, the St. Louis Rams, who had averaged 31 points a game up to the Super Bowl, were absolutely almost one of the greatest offensive forces of all time. Again, coming back to what I was telling you guys about with regards Belichick and his defensive genius, but more importantly, his ability to turn all this firepower into a weakness. He restricted that Rams team to just 17 points in a season in which they'd averaged 31 a game, right? In the Super Bowl. And then, of course, as I say, Mr. Clutch himself, Adam Vinatieri, stepped up to the moment. Again, carpe diem, thank you very much. Bang through those sticks. We're the champs. Lovely. But Belichick was actually fined the NFL record number, pushing, I think, $500,000. Plus, they lost the first round, a draft pick in the next term because of what was dubbed Spygate. Much like Leeds' manager was a little bit naughty of this in the last. Well, this I say last, it's still this season, isn't it? Against Derby, I think. But again, I think he did it for a sustained period of time. Anyway, Belichick basically had sort of drone-esque technology scoping out some of this greatest show on turf training moves and this and that. And he was fined a then record, I think it still remains a record, $500,000. Not a small sum, quite frankly, for him, just a drop in the ocean. But ultimately, that is on record. They don't deny it. Again, for him, it was just a case of, well, this has actually always happened. We've just been found guilty. We've been exposed. But this is normal, and everybody knows it's normal. And so let's just move on, can't we? And they did just move on. And again, ultimately, did that make a huge difference? Yeah, maybe it did. Maybe it was a crucial 1%er. Maybe it actually amounted to a 10%er. But in the final analysis, what was achieved, again, from a defensive perspective of an almost shutout against this untouchable offensive juggernaut of the Rams was, I think, still stands up, stands water, and will live on and is immortalized. The other one, again, was known as Deflategate. Bit of controversy. I think personally, this is one of those. Well, let's create a ginormous mountain out of what is basically a little mud pie. You know, there was talk about Brady, you know, loosen or reduce the grip on the balls, giving him a better grip strength in this and that. And again, you know, I think they were found guilty on it. Again, did that give them an edge? They did win, go on to win that bowl that year, et cetera, et cetera. For me, again, I feel as though that is a little bit of a neither here nor there. All told, let's not lose sight of this. Winningest 6 Super Bowl wins for Patriots since 2000. 17 AFC East division titles and 31 playoff wins for Bill Belichick. Of course, Brady, again, they go hand in glove, again, has those 6 Super Bowls. Even the great Montana can't come close to touching him. Peyton Manning looks up almost in awe of those 6 rings. So when the debate goes down, maybe when they have these little conversations, people can talk about stats and they can talk about this and that. For me, in the final analysis, whilst obviously we love the beautiful aspect of sport, we love the drama and the theatre, and it's all about the spectacle. When it's said and done, competitors want to win. And when you then have sort of a internal conversation, let's say, between Peyton Manning and, for instance, Brady about who's the GOAT, Brady just goes, all of those on those hands, and one more, my friend. I'll say no more. And that is, I guess, me resting my case for Dynasty New England Patriots. But gentlemen, I would love to get your views on this. And of course, yours listening, do tweet us at Verum Sport. Keep involved. Sporting dynasties, they are fantastic. And of course, they're wide and multifarious. Who is the greatest sporting dynasty of all time? We've not mentioned Liverpool of the 70s and into the 80s. Will they be coming a dynasty now under Klopp? We'll find out. That remains to be seen. What about those untouchables of Arsenal? Does a one-season wonder like that constitute dynasty? Again, I'd love your views. Tweet at Verulam Sport. And of course, we haven't even mentioned, really, except in passing, the mighty Stevenage's own Lewis Hamilton hunting down Schumacher's record of 7, seeming inexorably heading towards the winningest in the F1 world. Do tweet us at Verulam Sport and keep involved because, as always, this is your show every bit as much as it is ours. But now, thrown across first to Neil. Your thoughts on the New England Patriots and their role and their place in the world of sporting dynasty?
It's one of those games that I haven't really followed. But however, when you get a manager or a player that holds everything together and brings in such power and such insight into a game, you're going to move forward. And what he's done, what Bill's done there, is has taken the way things are done, like training, etc., and sort of turned it on its head. He takes the weakness, the strength away from the opposition, as you were saying, and turns it into a weakness, which they can then capitalise on, which teams have been, and going back to this Spygate, that sort of business, teams, if you like, have spies all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Scouts, whatever you want to call them. That it's done in every
sport.
These days,
it's YouTube and this and that, and there is no real privacy, is there, in 2020? But I think, again, that's a really, really good point. Jason, I'd be fascinated for your take on the philosophy almost that I've tried to explain there from Belichick.
Yeah, so just in terms of your point about Arsenal very quickly, you know, obviously I've got my Arsenal bias, but I would say that it probably is a dynasty because it's two doubles in terms of Premier League and FA Cup and an invincible. So just put that out there. But in terms of Belichick, undoubtedly, you know, the 6. I love that. If anything, I'm just a little bit sad that he didn't get 10. Then he could just put two hands up to people all the time.
He's still going. It ain't over yet. The Belichick story is far from finished.
So just, you know, if anybody says, who's the GOAT? Put those two hands up, me. But in terms of it, I think I see why you have such a liking and affinity to him as well. Because he is Mourinho-esque in that way. He is the person that kind of finds out, what is my team's weakness? Ah, right, we'll capitalise upon their best strength, their weaknesses and all things like that. And it is masterful. And I think it is a brilliant way to manage. You know, when you look at how Mourinho beat Guardiola in you know, on his own back turf in terms of La Liga, this was kind of Belichick kind of esque in many ways, kind of going, right, Barcelona like to play beautiful football. Let's combat them into the ground. In terms of it, though, as well, the philosophy seems to be pragmatic as well. But would you say that there's also some clear defining factors to Belichick? Or is it just Mr. Pragmatist finding out what his team need to do to combat the other team? Or is there something a little bit more there as well that maybe I'm not giving credit for right there, Tony?
Wonderful questions. And first and foremost, I'm going to give this much, because again, we're talking here not just dynasty, but almost the ingredients towards or behind these dynasties. And again, it stems from culture. And of course, Belichick has established that core culture coming from that military perspective. But I want to give a massive amount of credit here to Robert Kraft, who is the chairman, if you would, or the CEO of the Patriots, who essentially had the confidence in Belichick to do his thing. There was no ego there with Kraft. He trusted Belichick and empowered Belichick to do whatever was necessary in order to now form and forge this amazing dynasty. So credit, because again, culture comes from the highest level, and then he needs to be kind of almost mirrored in some kind of beautiful dynamic synergy down to the grassroots core. And when those things come together, that's when dynasties grow. But I'll tell you what, it's a great question, Jason. And to answer it, another aspect of the genius that is Belichick is that he took on an awful lot of, I wouldn't say misfits, but players who couldn't quite do it at other clubs or other places, no-namers, and got them to really become superstars. And also, another thing that was an emblem of this dynasty, they took on people like a Randy Moss, for instance. Now, I don't know if that name resonates with either of you, but Randy Moss is or was at the Minnesota Vikings, literally the man. He's up there with Jerry Rice as one of the all-time great wide receivers, all time. But he was known as a massive ego, a huge ego. And he never won anything at the Vikings. He put up amazing numbers personally, got made mega, mega dollars and had all the sponsorship and all of this and that and the other. But at the end of the day, he's a competitor. He wants those balls. And with Belichick, who embraced him, labeled again that season when it was Moss and Brady. Brady didn't, I think, ever put up higher numbers than when he had this great weapon at his disposal, Randy Moss, as his wideout, right? But again, when he came into the door at the Patriots, it was like, listen, Randy, we know you're good. That's why you're here. We know what you can do. Now, here's one question. Do you want a bowl or do you not want a bowl? If you want a bowl, then buy in and shut your mouth. Simple. And he bought in and he got that bowl. Okay. And ultimately, that's just one illustration. But again, there are many, many others, both in that kind of misfit type, who were then molded and became something of a star, which again, you could even argue the kind of apotheosis of that is Brady himself, for instance, right? But there were also a list of others that I can't recall instantaneously who would fit the Moss model, sort of ex-players or players with big reputations, big egos, big numbers, no bowls. And they came in to the Patriots and they bought in to the mantra, the philosophy, and the culture that they have there down. And again, that type of man management and that ability to engage with humongous egos and get them focused in on the culture of winning as opposed to individual successes is, I think, an absolute slice of genius. It combines an empathy allied to that kind of military stoicism, which is, I think, very, very rare. And for me, that is maybe the singular genius of this all-time great from the coaching perspective. Dynasty Pats stack up with all dynasties all time. But now, earlier on, we were discussing the cultural phenomenon of world wrestling entertainment. And I want to just quickly end tonight with the cultural phenomenon of the Premier League. Because, of course, we love that it's back. And I'm going across now to our newest recruit for his Premier League previews, starting with this Saturday, the 27th. Villas, the Villains are struggling right down in the bottom against the team we have praised and are on good form, the team from the West Midlands, Wolves, a West Midlands derby. Neil, your predictions, please.
Think a Wolves win.
Going away win in that fixture. Then moving on to Sunday, the 28th, the Hornets, Watford. What a wonder goal by Dawson. We're going to be talking to Richard Walker actually on Saturday. You'll hear him and his views, both reviewing that great goal from Dawson. How will they fare? We'll find out against Burnley when they tackle their old manager, Sean Dyche. And we'll then take on your Southampton on Sunday, the 28th. Stay tuned to hear from Richard Walker. But right here, right now, Southampton away at Vicarage Road. Neil, your thoughts?
I've got a feeling that one's going to be a draw.
go and draw, maybe curbing your natural Southampton enthusiasm there. But it's going to be an interesting game. Monday the 29th, we mentioned Burnley. Sean Dyche's Burnley. They were on good form, but they're free-falling a little bit, but I'm sure they'll be safe for the season. Similar things could well apply to Crystal Palace. They fight on Monday the 29th. Palace at home. Tackle Sean Dyche's Burnley. Neil, your thoughts?
A draw. I reckon that'll be a draw.
Go and draw in that one. Moving on to Tuesday the 30th. Brighton, again, we were heavily praising Graham Potter, who absolutely mullered the Gunners recently. Great. It looks to me that they've survived. How will they fare against the much-hyped Man United? We've praised them heavily under Solskjaer. Brighton at home versus Man United, Tuesday the 30th. Neil, your thoughts?
Away win.
Going Man United, the Red Devils getting a victory in there. And of course, they are one of the dynasties we've discussed tonight. Wednesday, July the 1st, it's a jam-packed fixture list. We've got the struggling Cherries of Bournemouth travelling to Steve Bruce's on-form Newcastle. Neil, your thoughts?
Newcastle win.
Newcastle win, I beg your pardon. They are the away team in that context, Bournemouth at home. Then it's the struggling Gunners against, again, Norwich. A bit of a strange conflict of allegiances in Clan McKenna that evening. Arsenal versus Norwich. Neil, quickly, your preview of that one, your thoughts?
Home win. I think Arsenal will actually pick up on that one.
Norwich are looking doomed. Gunners need to find some form, and you are going with a home win there. We'll divide Clan McKenna. We'll find out what the result is. Then it's Everton versus Leicester. Everton, the home team, taking on 2014 champs Leicester. It's your thoughts again, Neil?
I think Everton winning tonight could kickstart something again. I think Everton win.
Everton getting a win, another home win in that one. Then I wonder if it will be three straight home win predictions for you. West Ham, the Hammers, also struggling. Tackle Lampard's Chelsea. West Ham versus Chelsea. Neil, your thoughts?
London derby, I reckon a Chelsea win.
Interesting. Going away victory in that one. Okay. Moving on now to our final few previews for this week. On Thursday, July the 2nd, goodness me, I tell you what, it's so contracted and so thick and fast and harum-scarum, the Premier League, with no crowds in attendance. A little bit weird for me, but there we go. Sheffield United are struggling since the return of the Premier League. They host Jose Mourinho's Spurs. And Neil Stock, your thoughts on that one?
I'm thinking that's going to be, it could be a draw.
Got a draw.
Thinking a draw.
According to Neil Stock. And then this is a juicy one. Obviously, with Liverpool winning tonight, I think they only need two more points, one more win to claim the Premier League title for the first time. The first time they would have won the league since 1990-91 season. Man City, though, the defending champs, Pep Guardiola's Man City, would want to at least make them wait because they host Liverpool on Thursday, July the 2nd. It's a doozy. Your thoughts?
I reckon that's going to be most probably quite, if you like, it's going to be a boring game, that one. I reckon it's going to be a draw.
They often do play out like that, these ones that get so much hype. We'll see. And I'll tell you what has been an absolute fact for me tonight. No hype. This has been wonderful for me to debate, dissect the cultures of such a myriad and divergent array of sporting dynasties. Gentlemen, I've thoroughly enjoyed your company. Tell you what, I know you listening are a Premier League punditry guru. I'd love to hear your views on this week's upcoming fixtures. Continue to keep the machine busy across social media. Tweet us at Verum Sports. Again, love your opinions. Who have we missed out on sporting dynasties? Who deserves to be there? Tweet at Verum Sports. Keep engaged because always, this is your show every bit as much as it is ours. Make sure you're listening. You've got some great interviews coming from Jess King, still a footballing player. The highest level. She's travelled the world, though, doing it. A Liverpool player, I'm sure, excited for Liverpool successes, perhaps, in the league. Jess King is also the most recent acquisition to the wonderful Kickoff at 3 team, who are friends of the show. Great interview. Looking forward to your hearing that. Plus, we've got Will Slemming from Heart Sports Partnership telling us about the wonderful Box Clever program, which is going to get back underway. They've got massive and national lottery funding to do wonderful community work. Enjoy that one. Not only that, we're going to be chatting to our friend, head of comms from the Watford Football Club, Richard Walker, on Saturday, reviewing the drama of their return to the Premier League and, of course, previewing that match we've referenced against Neil Stock's own Southampton. All that ahead. Next week, we'll be having another awesome debate. We'll be open for you to dictate, by the power of democracy, exactly the content of that. So always keep your eye across social media and get involved. Want to hear from you. Appreciate your time and company. Gentlemen, as always, a sincere pleasure to enjoy your time and company. This has been Tony Rice for Verum Sport Podcasting. Keep listening. Thank you. Keep well. Keep safe. All the best.